tomorrow night, single digits below zero. Snow likely on Thursday, 1 to 2 inches, highs 24 to 32.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Remaking friends with the Canada-US trade relationship still very much on the rocks. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney heads to China.
And Champ Stamp. Lonnie Ali, wife of the late Muhammad Ali, tells us what it means to see him honored with a new postage stamp. She says most people probably think about his boxing prowess first, but his courage outside the ring is actually his lasting legacy.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
We'll have more ahead from As It Happens in a few moments here on People Powered KAXE. Support comes from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. And we thank Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Let's listen now to our album of the week. It's called Secret Love by Dry Cleaning. Dry Cleaning are a British rock band from London. This is their third full-length album. On Secret Love, the quartet expand their sound to include jangle pop guitars and elements of folk rock. It was produced by in-demand indie producer Kate Laban and partly recorded at Wilco's The Loft Studio. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear this evening from Dry Cleaning is called Hit My Head All Day.
Life, a series of memorials and signals, telling us this or that, telling us this or this. Think of that. The objects outside there control the moment to arrange them.
Ha 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 ha
From our album of the week, that's Dry Cleaning with Hit My Head All Day. You can read more about that album and more fresh picks at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Any export in a storm. Prime Minister Mark Carney is off to Beijing, and a former Canadian ambassador to China tells us he will need to balance security and human rights concerns on one side and the need for new trade commitments on the other.
Fed up. High-level economic officials in the U.S. come to the defense of Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, who says criminal allegations are just part of Donald Trump's attempt to politicize the central bank.
Something in the water. The executive director of Kaseshawan First Nation is racing to get people out after its water treatment plant failed. He says help and a permanent fix cannot come fast enough.
A small problem with billions of small problems. It's still true that microplastics are pretty much everywhere, but our guest says some high-profile assertions about their impact on the human body may have been overblown.
A real knockout. The U.S. Postal Service recognizes Muhammad Ali with an official stamp, and his widow tells us she's pleased as punch.
And they can't fly, but sparks will. Good news for the flightless parrot known as the kakapo. A bumper crop of berries means a future bumper crop of baby kakapos. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that's kind of a chick magnet. For the first time in years, there's a clear sign of a thaw in Canada-China relations. Today, Prime Minister Mark Carney is traveling to Beijing for a face-to-face meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. It will be the first time a Canadian Prime Minister has been welcomed there in almost a decade. Canada's relationship with China was damaged by mutual tariffs, accusations of foreign interference, and other diplomatic tensions. And the stakes are also high, of course, because Canada needs to expand its trading partners. Just today, U.S. President Donald Trump said Kuzma has, quote, no real advantage for his country, and that Americans don't need Canadian products. Guy Saint-Jacques was Canada's ambassador to China from 2012 to 2016. He's now a senior fellow at the China Institute at the University of Alberta. We reached him in Montreal.
Guy Saint-Jacques, this is not an insignificant first, another first, as these two countries try to reset this relationship. It's fraught, it could be. So what in the end, after it's all done, would signal to you that this was actually a success for Prime Minister Carney and Canadians?
Well, I hope that there's not been such an official visit visit for about 8 years. And because it's an official visit, it gives an opportunity to raise a number of very important geopolitical issues. In terms of trade, Prime Minister Carney wants to expand markets and better use existing ones. So I expect that there will be a greater clarity coming out of that, and that there will be many agreements or memoranda of understanding that will be signed.
A lot of competing interests, even within Canada. As you know, Saskatchewan's Premier Scott Moe is going to be joining Prime Minister Carney for part of the trip. Obviously, he wants to try to get some relief for canola producers in Saskatchewan. At the same time, Ontario's Premier Doug Ford is concerned that dropping tariffs on EVs might be on the table as these discussions go forward tomorrow. We have a little bit of what Premier Ford said on that issue today to reporters.
When you have the Chinese government wanting to dump cheap Chinese parts and cheap vehicles here, it costs the Canadian and American jobs. So I'm absolutely 100% dead against this. I have not talked to the Prime Minister. I will speak to him and tell him our concerns. And this is nothing against the folks in the canola business or soybean. We have a thriving soybean business here too. So it's not about them. I fully understand why Premier Mo is concerned, but he's protecting Saskatchewan. I'm protecting Ontario.
So Guy Saint-Jacques, can both premiers, both provinces leave happy after these meetings are done, or is something going to have to give?
I think something will have to give. And when I was in Ottawa last fall, I had discussions where I was told that there would be trade-offs eventually. You know, when you look at canola, you talk about $4 billion amount of trade. So it's very significant. So I think that there could be an announcement saying that Canada will do a full study based on the regulations of the World Trade Organization, similar to what the European Union did. And this could eventually lower the tariffs. I think it could be completed in a few months, and it would lower the tariffs probably to between 15 and 40%. I wouldn't be surprised if Prime Minister could invite a Chinese EV car manufacturer to come to Canada to build a plan that would help to guarantee jobs in Ontario.
Then there are the issues of security, questions of foreign interference, certainly prevalent in recent years. The former diplomat Michael Kovrig, listeners will remember him as one of the Michaels detained in China. He was speaking to Politico and said, quote, "My concern is that the Canadian government could make concessions on national security and policy autonomy and mute its diplomacy about problematic Chinese government behavior in return for economic benefits. That would be a strategic error because it would contribute to emboldening the Chinese Communist Party to be even more aggressive in expanding its influence," unquote. We know that the Prime Minister, even in the 2025 election campaign, said China is Canada's biggest security threat. So what are you watching for to make sure that, that Canada protects itself on those fronts?
Well, the Prime Minister has a number of objectives going into that mission. One, of course, is to increase our exports to China. I think also he will want to clarify rules with regard to Chinese investment in Canada, because he knows we need foreign investment. You know, it would be great also to get Chinese investment in battery plants and so on. But he has also another objective. He has to convince the Canadian public that he takes this issue very seriously. You know, we learned a lot during the UGG Commission. And I think he will tell Chinese leaders, look, when you say that you respect territorial integrity, sovereignty, well, your interference goes directly against that. This constitutes a red line for Canada. And if we find instances where your officials engage in such interference, either in our Canadian politics or if they arrest Canadians of Chinese origin, we will react very strongly. And so I think that the good news from my perspective is that the Prime Minister is perceived as a serious and competent leader by the Chinese leader, which means that he can raise sensitive issues with them. So he can achieve both results in terms of trade, but also in reassuring Canadians that for him, national security is a paramount concern.
As you have likely seen, Liberal MPs had to cut their trip to Taiwan short this week because it would have overlapped with the Prime Minister's visit to Beijing. There are concerns about what that signals. Should Taiwan be worried?
I think in the case of those two Liberal MPs, the Prime Minister wanted to send a signal that this is a recalibration of the relationship, a reset. You know, we should encourage visit by MPs, by senators to Taiwan. It's a good place to do business. They respect rules, which is not always the case in China.
So you clearly see the potential for a lot of positives here. But going back to what Michael Kovrig said and what he told Politico, do you share any of his concerns that in its need to build these kinds of economic relationships because of what's happening and not happening with the U.S., that Canada might give up too much?
I hope not. Apparently, when Xi Jinping met with Prime Minister Carney at the APEC summit at the end of October in South Korea, he told him, yes, I want to have better relations. And if you are looking for a model, look to Jiang Kai-shek. I was in China when Jiang Kai-shek was prime minister. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that the prime minister would raise concerns on human rights. He would do this in a private, respectful manner. And he would not emphasize this in his public declaration. And there was also trade going on. Again, because Mr. Carney is seen as a serious leader, I'm confident that he can raise these issues and reassure Canadians that he takes national security very strongly.
Guy Saint-Jacques, thank you for coming back on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Guy Saint-Jacques was Canada's ambassador to China from 2012 to 2016. He's in Montreal. Kashetchewan First Nation needs to get its people out. The fly-in community in northern Ontario is in the midst of a crisis brought on by a failure at its water treatment plant, which led it to declare a state of emergency on January 4th. Since then, residents have gradually been evacuated to several cities in Ontario, starting with the most vulnerable people. But there are still hundreds more waiting to leave, and time is of the essence. Tyson Wesley is the executive director of Kashetchewan First Nation, and that's where we reached him.
Tyson, as we speak, what is the latest count? How many people have you been able to get out of the community so far?
Yeah, the latest count for just from yesterday's flight was 668, roughly, but we still have people that are flying out today.
And how many more?
We hope to evacuate the whole community. The population's roughly around 2,300 people, so I'd say about 15 or close to 1,500 left. I think, our partners are targeting for Sunday to finish the evacuations.
In the middle of all of this, folks are also dealing with a gastrointestinal outbreak. Do you have a sense at this stage of whether that is linked to the water situation or something else?
I think there's no real evidence as of yet, but I think our concerns are have been discussed with health partners in each host site and also in the community. Mm-hmm. We've asked for additional tests for people that have gastro issues, and if it is the water, we want to make sure that they are getting the best treatment that they can. But right now, just there might be a correlation, but we can't really say.
Yeah. And how many people are dealing with that? How widespread are the symptoms?
I can't really say, like, in terms of numbers with the community, but it is a concerning number that we've noticed, and we want to make sure that they are tested and then to be sure what it is.
The First Nation, to let our listeners know, has been under a state of emergency for nearly 10 days now. If you think back to what might have started all of this, what caused the failure, do you think? Do you know at this point at the treatment plant?
Yeah, I think it's the lack of, I think we have aging infrastructure in the community, and it just started to break. And with the sewage kind of backing up also in the clinic, we do have aging infrastructure in the community too, such as the clinic. So it's just a lack of funding over the years and lack of investment from the government that kind of led to where we were. Even with the, I think a lot of questions have been raised regarding our maintenance procedures, but I've been telling government officials, well, it's really hard to fix a clogged sewage line when the only thing you have is a fire truck. So, but we're doing we're doing as best as we can with what we're given. So,
have you been concerned that something like this could happen? I mean, you've had issues in the past, obviously, but have you been warning them that this isn't just a simple fix?
This is actually Kashetchewan's second water evacuation, I think, this in the span of a year and a half. Last year, 300 of our members were evacuated to Thunder Bay back in December 2024, which led to more funding being provided by the government. But I guess the repairs haven't been adequately made to the situation that we've been dealing with now.
A spokesperson for Indigenous Services Canada told our CBC News colleagues repairs are being done at the treatment plant. Are you seeing that happen? Do you feel that this is going to be resolved soon?
Yes, we have divers coming in tomorrow to check out the intake system, and also a team coming in to defrost our hydrants, and we have a team in the water plant making all the repairs that they're making, and we're not sure when everything will be done, but we want to make sure that all our community members are safe and making sure the infrastructure is adequate for that, for us to bring them back. So
And how do you feel? I mean, the work is being done, but what's your sense if it's the kind of work that's going to prevent this from happening again?
Part of what we've been asking for is kind of an assessment of the current water plant and see how we can make sure that this doesn't happen again. If you look at the history of Kashetchewan, we've been in conversations with the government for over 18 years about relocating our community. So we do get evacuated every year for the past 18 years. I think sometimes we don't, but it's an almost like a yearly occurrence that happens here. So the long-term fix is relocating us into a location where it's not prone to flooding.
Yeah. And what are they telling you as they get on those planes or get packed up to leave again under these circumstances?
It's circumstances not of their choosing. I think it is frustrating to have to leave your family, have to kind of leave with your family to be in an urban center such as Kingston, Niagara Falls, and Timmins at Kapuskasing. You seem to be away from your home, so and to be in a hotel for long periods of time. So we understand the frustration of our people, and that's something that we've always heard. But the situation warrants an evacuation, and we're trying to do our best to make sure that they're safe.
You've all been relying on bottled water, obviously. What is that supply like as we speak?
It's a steady supply. I think we did have concerns throughout the week or throughout the start of our evacuation that we might have some issues bringing in supplies if weather didn't cooperate.
Do you think that, I mean, at this point, given the other seasonal evacuations that happen, as you mentioned, that folks will be out of their homes till the spring?
I don't know. It's just upsetting that if we do come home, that we might have to go out again. But most likely, our most vulnerable will be evacuated. That's been standard practice on our area, in our First Nation, for quite a long time, because we know that we don't want to take risks with our people.
Tyson, I thank you for this. Please take care.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for calling, and thank you.
Tyson Wesley is the executive director of Keshechewan First Nation. That's where we reached him. We requested comment from Indigenous Services Canada, but we didn't hear back by airtime. It's hard to sum up everything three-time heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali achieved. He's considered by many, of course, to have been the greatest boxer of all time. He was also a key figure in the civil rights movement, an award-winning humanitarian, and a cultural icon. Now, an official stamp by the U.S. Postal Service will honor his multifaceted legacy. On that stamp, he's looking directly out at you, his boxing gloves up to his chin, ready for a fight. The stamp will be unveiled at his birthplace in Louisville, Kentucky, later this week. Lonnie Ali is Muhammad Ali's widow. We reached her in Louisville, Kentucky.
Lonnie Ali, I think a lot of our listeners, a lot of people will be very surprised to learn that Muhammad Ali didn't already have a stamp dedicated to him. Why did it take so long?
Well, first let me say Muhammad would share with them in that surprise that he did not have a stamp before now. But, you know, all good things in time. And it's wonderful that we have it now because it celebrates his birthday, which is coming up, his 84th birthday, January 17th. Oh. So it's a wonderful birthday gift for him. But it took a while because I don't think we thought about it at first. And there was a gentleman who had just joined our board here at the Muhammad Ali Center in Louisville who was looking at some photographs with me of Muhammad, some old photographs, and he asked me, he goes, Lonnie, does Muhammad have a stamp? Mm. I said, no. He said, why not? I said, I don't know.
Let's fix
that.
So
he took it upon himself to take on that charge and lead this campaign, get the champ a stamp, and here we are today celebrating Mr. Ali on a forever stamp.
There are so many wonderful images of Muhammad Ali, your husband, out there in the world. As they were narrowing this down, I mean, was it your say, the final say? Are you and your board? How was the decision made to land on the image that you landed on?
Well, actually, the image was selected from an AP photo that was taken of Muhammad, probably early mid-career. And I think they took it because of that's the way most people relate to Muhammad in the ring as a boxer. That's probably their first introduction to him, and I think that's why they chose that particular kind of photograph, a boxing photograph. But I think the one they chose shows that Muhammad was a man of courage and conviction. You can sort of see that in his face. Mm-hmm. He was a master at his craft, very proud of the way he performed in the ring. But that wasn't his enduring legacy. His enduring legacy is the things that he did outside of the ring. And I think because this is a forever stamp, that speaks to that legacy that endures forever.
Yeah. And I think people know, but in case they don't, a forever stamp means even if the postage that you have to pay changes, the stamp will still be valid when you send a letter.
Right. It's like Muhammad. He never, his legacy never changes. It's always giving. It's like, regardless of what happens in the world, that legacy can always be counted on.
He was so outspoken, always said what was on his mind. What do you think the power of this stamp could be at this particular time in history, particularly in the United States?
Well, I think, when people look at this stamp, and that's what's so wonderful about it being a forever stamp, is that Muhammad did speak his mind, and he was authentic to his core and stood on his convictions and his principles, had no problems in telling people what he thought. And usually Muhammad was right. In fact, most of the time he was right.
Did you tell him that when he was alive, or you just...
No, he knew it. Muhammad had wisdom beyond his years. I mean, if you go back and look at some of his interviews with Michael Parkinson, for instance, some of the things Muhammad was saying even then, I mean, are relative today. He just had that sort of global, universal wisdom. The lessons that he taught, but he led by action, by what he did, endure today as well. Muhammad was a man of kindness and compassion and, believe it or not, humility. I know that's hard to believe, but it's true. He was very humble in his approach to people. He approached people one-on-one. He didn't have social media. And so he made that human connection one-on-one. And it's something that example still needs to be followed, because nowadays, we depend so much on mechanical ways, technology to connect with people, when it's better to really connect one-on-one, face-to-face. And that's what he liked to do, and he liked to find out about the people he was talking to, the fans he made.
You've been doing this work for such a long time, Lonnie, keeping, his memory and his legacy preserved and alive, certainly. But he was your husband, someone you loved, and you had to share him with so many people. I wonder how you're doing now.
Well, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of his passing, June 3rd of 2026, and it really does not feel like that. It feels like it happened last year. It doesn't feel like he's been gone that long. But then again, like I said, a lot of that is because of the relevance of his legacy and how strong his voice still is. I'm doing well. I mean, I'm blessed. Muhammad always looked at life as the glass half full, not half empty, and he was always grateful for the blessings God gave him, and I feel the same way. Yes, we all have challenges. He had challenges, but you overcome those challenges one by one. And he never found anything daunting. Muhammad never let anything get in his way of achieving what he wanted to achieve, and set that example for all of us, not only for me, but for his children as well. So that's what I do. I approach each day one day at a time. I bite off as much as I can chew and keep moving. There's always something positive to be found in every day. And, part of that is being grateful for the blessings that you've received.
Lonnie, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you for this, and have a good time on Thursday.
Well, thank you. I will. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Lonnie Ali is the widow of Muhammad Ali. She's in Louisville, Kentucky. You don't need a mentor, but may I take you under my wing? You want to help me put together a little nest egg? I can't fly, but when you're around, my heart's a flutter. If male kakapos could talk, those are definitely the kinds of pickup lines they would use because they're great. But they can't. So this is their pickup line. The booming of a male kakapo, profoundly sensual on its own, but then the male starts throwing in some chings. According to scientists, the booms say, "Hey girl," and the chings say, "I'm over here." I'm paraphrasing. And the people working to restore the kakapo population in New Zealand are about to be surrounded by those sexy sounds of seduction because it is Remo berry season and the harvest is plump. The kakapo is a rotund, flightless parrot and a two-time winner, of course, of the coveted New Zealand Bird of the Year title. It is also endangered, so breeding season is important, but it's dependent on the size of the Remu berry crop. The bigger the crop, the more kakapo chicks can be fed. And this year, Deidre Vercoe, who's in charge of kakapo recovery for New Zealand's Department of Conservation, told The Guardian, quote, "We've got a really big Remu crop developing on the trees, and the birds haven't bred for 4 years, so we're hoping that they will all get into the action this summer," unquote. I'm sorry, I should have warned you about her language. But thanks to conservationists' efforts, the population has grown from 51 in 1995 to 236 today. And with this bumper berry crop, we do hope these kakapos are pro-procreation. And they will be, as long as the males find a way to communicate something like, "They call me the business because I'm always booming." Here's John Langford and the Sadies with Strange Birds.
Empty out your pockets, the papers and the money, the names and faces of the worlds where days are bright and sunny. There's someone here you may have met, or maybe just forgotten. In the half-light, clothes all wet, I wonder how this happened. Take the best and dump the rest, whisper your intentions. Strange birds sing of frightening things, too obvious to mention. Patterns in the fabric fade, the loose threads are unfurling. The red room flows out through the door, and the city pub shuts early. Well, I'll pull on my iron shirt and walk out in the city, back to see the ones I love, the ones who won't desert me. Take the best and dump the rest, whisper your intentions. Strange birds sing frightening things, too obvious to mention.
John Langford and the Sadies with Strange Birds.
We're going to take a quick break now. When we return, I'll speak with one of the 13 former economic leaders from both sides of the aisle speaking out against the criminal investigation into Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. Our guest says it is a naked attempt to undermine the independence of the Fed and can only end badly for the American people.
And for what may have been the last time, Raptors legend Kyle Lowry stepped onto the court in Toronto and the crowd went wild. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Cooksall.
Dump the rest, whisper your intentions. Strange birds sing of frightening things, too obvious to mention. Strange birds sing of frightening things, too obvious.
Thank you.
for listening to As It Happens on People Powered, KAXC, KBXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, Headwaters with Malachi Coons. More great music. Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. We also thank Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about their dinner menu at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Our weather forecast: lows tonight in the single digits with blustery north wind, and tomorrow sunny, highs 10 to 15. Snow likely on Thursday, 1 to 2 inches.
Donald Trump has wanted lower interest rates for a while now, and since they are still not as low as he'd like them to be, he has lashed out at the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell. The U.S. president has insulted Mr. Powell repeatedly, calling him a, quote, political hack who has, quote, some real mental problems. He has threatened to fire Mr. Powell. And then last week, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia opened a criminal investigation into Mr. Powell and the Federal Reserve. The ostensible reason is renovations to the Fed's headquarters. The claim is that Jerome Powell lied to Congress about the project, which has gone over budget. But on the weekend, Mr. Powell issued a rare public rebuttal. And now a number of former economic officials have signed on to a letter condemning the probe, including every living former head of the Federal Reserve. Jared Bernstein is the former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors and one of the signatories. We reached him in Alexandria, Virginia.
Jared Bernstein, certainly it's not surprising given what the U.S. president has said, you know, in terms of how he feels about Jerome Powell. But were you surprised to see this action, a criminal investigation launched against him?
I wasn't particularly surprised because of President Trump's long-term actions against this Fed chair, ratcheting things up on the basis of this extremely flimsy and evidence-free case, this idea that the chair of the Fed misrepresented himself to Congress about the renovations, is so clearly a pretext that Trump has very few defenders in this case. So when I heard it, I wasn't particularly surprised, but I thought it was an unusually weak and messy attempt by the president to go after Powell.
You are among several signatories, more than a dozen, both sides of the aisle, served all sorts of different presidents, signing a letter to condemn this move by the Justice Department. What do you hope it can achieve, given what we've seen from this administration?
Well, our hope was that it would elevate this issue so that people on both sides of the aisle would recognize it for what it is, a complete and evidence-free attempt to compromise and politicize the independence of our central bank. Chair Powell was clear in his own video, which was the first time he really responded so explicitly to these charges, or even at all. He called these charges a pretext. The president has long suggested he wants to take over interest rate policy, and that, again, would be compromising the independence of the Federal Reserve and of the practice of monetary policy. And literally in every country where that has happened, it has ended very badly for the economy and for the living standards of the people in that economy.
Jerome Powell's term as chair is set to end in a few months. As you know, Republicans are signaling this crosses a line for them. How likely is it, in your view, that the U.S. president will manage to do what he wants to do and replace Jerome Powell with someone he feels is better suited to the job or more loyal to him personally?
Well, the way this works under U.S. law is that the president will have an opportunity to do that in May of this year. That's when Jerome Powell's term as chair of the Federal Reserve runs out, and the president can nominate. The Senate will thereby have to approve the next Fed chair. If you're asking me if I think that this criminal investigation will go anywhere, I'm quite confident it won't. And again, the way things work in our courts is that you have to get a grand jury, the Justice Department have to get a grand jury to indict Powell. And based on the evidence of the case, I'm actually quite skeptical they'll even be able to get that far.
What does it signal to you, though, if they're willing to do this at this stage, what might come next?
Well, if it hadn't been for the reaction to what they did, my answer to you would have been they'll just keep pushing, they'll keep trying ways to litigate against members of the Federal Reserve who set interest rate policy in ways that make President Trump unhappy. And he's already done that against one of the Fed governors, Lisa Cook. So mm-hmm. I would have said they'll just keep doing that. But you can't overestimate the blowback the president has gotten here. I mean, many newspaper articles, including in one of our conservative newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, they editorialized today against this, talking about how it was going to backfire. So it's possible that the reaction has been so negative to this overstep, this evidence-free overstep of this president to compromise Fed independence, that perhaps they'll back off a little bit, but, you know, I probably wouldn't bet much on it.
We know he wants, you know, he wants more cuts. The U.S. president has said there were three in your country since September, if I'm not mistaken. Are they where they should be, in your view?
I would say that the Federal Reserve's interest rate right now, set in the mid-threes, is about where it should be. Maybe another quarter point cut or two will be necessary, but I don't think that's the case right now. And in fact, we've had some recent issues here with what's called stagflation, meaning inflation that's higher than we like, at the same time while the job market is softer than we like. And those push the Fed in different directions.
The independence of the Bank of Canada has certainly come up in this country in recent years, the importance of that. You've talked about examples around the world, many, many examples, and it's you cite that in the letter that you've signed as well. What do you want listeners, whether they are here in Canada or in the United States or elsewhere, to know about what that kind of intervention by the president means for them and their economy?
What it means is that instead of making key decisions on key economic variables based on the evidence, based on what the data tells you, based on what makes most sense for economic conditions as they appear, those decisions would be made at the behest of politicians who want to juice the economy for their own political reasons. And the result, and you ask the key question, what does this mean for everyday folks? Because if all this stuff is kind of arcane and happening in the background, it doesn't matter. Well, they tried this in Turkey not that long ago, and inflation went up to 85%. And that's obviously going to ruin lives for a lot of people and businesses. Now, I'm not predicting that in our cases, in both of our more developed economies. I don't think we'd see that kind of inflationary shock, but we certainly could see double digits. And again, if history is a guide, not only would we see higher inflation, we'd see higher interest rates, higher mortgage rates, auto loans, credit markets would be much less accessible. And so eventually the pain does really affect everyday folks.
Jared Bernstein, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Jared Bernstein is the former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He's in Alexandria, Virginia. A horrifying picture is emerging in Iran. For the first time in days, people inside the country have been able to contact the outside world, albeit infrequently. They're sharing stories and videos of the regime's brutal crackdown on protesters. Snipers on top of buildings, government forces seemingly firing on crowds, and rows of body bags. It's still impossible to know the full extent of the death toll, but it's now estimated to be at least 2,000, possibly more. The country has been under an internet blackout since last week, but some people who have Starlink terminals were able to make calls out at great personal risk. Security forces are reportedly searching for the devices. We asked our guest from last night's program, Farnaz Ohadi, to send us an update on her family.
I was able to hear from my family in Iran and they're safe and they have been hiding their equipment. So thank you for following up on that. We are getting some news from the inside of people who have been able to access some kind of internet. Often it seems to be near embassies that have left their Wi-Fi's open so people can use internet to send very, very short videos. And I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. Just please help the Iranian people. They're innocent. All they're asking for is to live a normal life. And this is not what they deserve. This regime is criminal. And what they're doing is just unbelievable. We need the international community to step up, for UN to send a convoy immediately to document and observe what is happening, for them to be kicked out of the UN, for them to be kicked out of the Olympics, and all the embassies to be closed. Please do not do any military action, but do ostracize them and make this government understand that if they do it this way, they do not belong to the world at large. Please help the Iranian people.
That was Iranian-Canadian Farnaz Ohadi giving us an update on her family. Bivalves happily gobble up microplastics. Okay, what else am I? Right. Microplastics seem to have a way of polluting just about every place on Earth. What else do I have here? Researchers are finding plastic waste just about everywhere. These are all things that I have said on this program about microplastics, and they're not wrong. Microplastics are a huge problem, or I suppose a very, very small one, and I regret to inform you that that is still true. But it might not be quite as true as you've been led to believe by, us and scientists and other news outlets around the world. Damian Carrington is an environment editor for the British newspaper The Guardian. It's just published a new analysis that calls into question a number of high-profile papers on the presence of microplastics in the human body in particular. We reached Mr. Carrington in Ilfracombe, England.
Damien, as you well know, people have been told that microplastics are everywhere, in their brains, their reproductive organs, their blood. What first made you start to wonder that some of those claims might be overstating things?
Well, like many journalists, I've been really struck by the scientific studies that were coming out, as you say, identifying microplastics and nanoplastics in, you know, testes and placenta and all sorts of places. But during the course of last year, a few of the scientists in the field had started to contact me and say that, some of these papers they were really rather concerned about and thought that they looked like they were finding very large amounts in unusual places. So at that time I said, well, you know, I'm not a scientist, I can't really adjudicate on this, and let's just wait and see. But what's happened is that academics, researchers have started writing to the journals and formally saying, we think there's a problem potentially with these papers, and I found seven of those, and another paper I found had listed 18 studies which hadn't perhaps done all the checks that they might have done. And so at that point I thought, well, actually there really is something to see here, so let's get stuck in.
Why do you think this might be happening?
Well, there's a number of reasons. The first and most obvious is that micro and nanoplastics are absolutely tiny and therefore really, really hard to analyse. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem. I think the other problem is it's a very exciting and very young field, so lots of researchers are rushing into it, and certainly some have come from outside the field of analytical chemistry. And some of the researchers that I was talking to said that, you know, some of the people, say, from the medical world perhaps have, you know, got the expertise in terms of our bodies, but might not have as much experience or expertise in terms of the actual analysis. So I think, yeah, the problem is it's really hard, it's really new, and not everybody has all of the expertise they might need. But, you know, science is self-correcting to a certain degree. You know, people put results out there and they expect to be criticised. You know, results need to be replicated. Other people have to try and find similar results in order to be really sure of these things.
I know you spoke with some of the researchers whose work other scientists are now challenging. What did they tell you?
Well, you know, some of them said that, you know, it's a new field and we're having to investigate these things as we go along. I mean, of course, you know, some of the scientists criticised the criticisms, if you see what I mean. They said, well, you know, we don't take on board all of these criticisms. Actually, you've misinterpreted the data here. So it's the normal process of, you know, scientific discovery. And I think outside of the scientific journals, you know, some of the criticism has been, let's say, undiplomatic. You know, one paper was called a joke. You know, other people have said this is a bombshell, the revelations that, you know, some of the detections might actually be what they call false positives. So in the case of the brain, one of the issues is that the analytical technique they use there can also get the same signal from fat that exists in the human brain.
And the person who used the word bombshell used to work for Dow. Is that right?
Well, that's true. Yeah, certainly. You know, the plastic industry has a long and not very noble history of, you know, lobbying against restrictions on plastic. But I think in this case, you know, there are many other people who are just, you know, regular academic scientists with no financial links to the plastics industry. So I don't think this is, you know, a critique that's been got up by plastic lobbyists.
You do write in your piece that the errors in this field of research could, quote, help lobbyists for the plastics industry dismiss real concerns by claiming they're unfounded, unquote. As a journalist, you're always looking for answers. We want to be as transparent as always with our listeners and your readers, of course. How did you weigh those kinds of concerns that you just talked about and the importance of reporting on the latest information?
Well, I think as you know, most journalists, you want to try and tell people, your readers or your listeners, what's going on in the world to the best of your ability. And, you know, last August, I ran a very long piece that was extremely critical of the plastic and petrochemical industries in terms of how they tried to block progress. And in fact, were very successful in blocking progress with the Global Plastic Treaty that the UN were negotiating last year. So I don't think I'm any friend of the plastic industry. And in this case, you know, I've just tried to tell the story as I see it. You know, it's not saying that microplastics and nanoplastics are not a problem, right? We know that the entire world is polluted by micro and nanoplastics from the top of Mount Everest to the bottom of the deepest ocean trench. The question is, when it gets into the body, how much of it does the body naturally excrete and how much remains in the body and where does it go? And it seemed like we knew quite a lot that it was getting into places like, you know, arteries and placenta and all these other places. But now, based on, you know, the reporting that I've done here and the work that and the critiques that have come from some of the scientists, it seems we're not quite so sure about, you know, how much is in the body and where it is.
And ultimately, what do you want people who are listening to our conversation, reading your pieces, you know, people who maybe were really anxious about microplastics, what do you want them to take away from all of this?
Well, that's exactly the question I asked all the scientists I spoke to as well, because it's, it's of course, the important question. What do we do in our own lives? And one really notable thing, I think, was that all the scientists I spoke to were taking measures in their own lives to limit their exposure to plastic, certainly on the basis that it can't hurt. You know, it's the kind of precautionary way to do it. So, you know, one of the scientists ventilates her house fairly regularly. Another doesn't reheat food in plastic containers. So I think, you know, taking sensible precautions would certainly be a good idea. But, you know, there have been reports of, you know, companies offering to clean your blood, you know, you go into a lab. I mean, that's kind of crazy. And certainly the evidence that exists so far would not suggest that you should have anything to do with that kind of thing, especially when it costs, you know, thousands of dollars. So I think, you know, taking sensible precautions, that's what the advice I got given, you know, by the scientists. But at the moment, we just don't know enough to be taking anything that, you know, might be considered more drastic, I think.
Glad we could speak, Damien. I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Damien Carrington is an environment editor for The Guardian. We reached him in Ilfracombe, England. The score was 114-98. The Raptors were down. But the Toronto crowd was going wild because that meant there was an opportunity for one member of the opposing Philadelphia 76ers, who had spent the game on the bench until that point, to get on the court. And here's what it sounded like with less than 2 minutes left in the fourth quarter at Scotiabank Arena last night.
Looking down at Kyle Lowry. North Philly's finest. Entering the game, and look at Tyrese Maxey. A standing ovation for the greatest Raptor of all time.
The moment Raptors all-time great Kyle Lowry stepped on the court in Toronto for possibly the last time. There had been chants of "We want Lowry" from the crowd earlier in the game. And finally, 76ers coach Nick Nurse, who also, of course, led Toronto's 2019 championship team, put him in. In a post-game press conference, Mr. Lowry was asked about that moment.
Take us through, I guess, the discussions with Nick leading up to the game. Was the plan always to get you in there? Was it situational, or did that kind of happen organically?
I think it just happened organically. I think the guys, I think tonight our team came out with an extreme focus, and I think that's part of their plan is to, make sure I got an opportunity to get in there. And I got some great teammates and, a great coach who understands the moment, who I have a championship with, but it was a good team win for us, and I got an opportunity to experience probably one of the greatest basketball moments of my personal career.
Before that moment, what was it like sitting on the bench and hearing those chants?
I had Trendon Wofford, in the, next to me, sit on the bench, and he was like, "Come on, Kyle, you gotta go in, get what you're waiting for." And it was just—it's cool to have teammates like that and just listen to the fans. And I mean, that's why I always say, they are the greatest fans in the world to me. They've been supportive of me and my career. And, a lot of the things I've accomplished in my career was in front of these fans. And, that's why, this place is so special to me.
Kyle Lowry speaking last night. He has also said it's his plan to eventually sign a one-day contract and retire as a Raptor. The relationship between Mr. Lowry and Raptors fans is special. As you heard, he considers them the greatest fans in the world, which they proved by cheering the team on during its 2019 NBA championship run and afterwards at the parade to celebrate the victory. At the time, our former host Carol Off talked to Raptors fan Brian Canonigo, who took the day off work to be at the parade.
Oh my gosh, man, you have no idea. I've never seen so much people in Toronto. It's crazy, man. Like, the whole city, the whole country is in here. Black, white, brown, yellow, all kinds of races, all nationalities, all religions. They're all in here.
What's the mood?
Lots of energy. Lots of people screaming. Kids. There's people with trumpets. People are on the light post. They're all screaming. We were so close to the players. We saw a glimpse of them. And I was probably 4 or 5 meters away from these guys.
So basically what we can see from, what I can see from the television, not being out there, was that the players were on the buses. They're down very, very slowly, as you know, headed toward Nathan Phillips Square. You got them at the beginning, they were fresh. Were you getting doused with champagne as people are getting elsewhere?
Yeah, it was crazy. It was Danny Green. Danny Green with his forehawk, he was just popping champagne. Norman Powell was beside him, and Norman Powell was just like, "Give me your shirt, give me your hat," and he was just signing autographs right there and then. And he would just throw it right back. It was amazing, man. It was amazing.
From our archives, that was Brian Canonigo speaking to former As It Happens host Carol Off in 2019.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.